Let's play some cards.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring Team Poker Stars pro Dennis Phillips with Paul Harris. Brought to you by Poker Stars and the Poker Players Alliance.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner.
You got it.
Now, from the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan KFNS.
Thank you, sir. May I have another?
We start the show today with a spoiler alert. For the next hour, we will be talking about the November 9 playing down to the final one at the World Series of Poker main event. This will not air on ESPN for another 6 hours, but because Dennis was there and because I was paying attention to it all weekend long and watching it online, we are going to get into the details of it. If you don't want to know who won the event, come back to the show as a podcast later on thechipleader.com. But if you want to have some in-depth analysis, we will have one of the members of the November 9 join us in just a couple of minutes. Hello, welcome to the Final Table. I'm Paul Harris, sitting at table two in the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, while my partner Dennis Phillips is once again out in Las Vegas, where last night he was table side for the big heads-up finale between the final two, the Canadian Jonathan Duhamel and the Floridian John Raisner, both of whom had been guests on this show, both of whom put together the youngest heads-up battle in World Series Final Table history, with Duhamel coming out on top. The 23-year-old beat the 24-year-old to take down nearly $9 million. Dennis, you were there last night. What was the scene like?
Well, it was amazing. But the first thing I got to comment, you got to keep talking about these ages. You realize their combined age doesn't even equal mine.
Or mine. Yeah, I know.
These guys definitely did not play like 20-year-olds. There is no doubt about it. They battled through all of this in July. Battled through the break where you have tons of pressure at you, tons of media people coming at you and everything like that. We're able to sit down at that table with the other seven and play a heck of a match for over 200 hands to get down to heads up, and then played 43 more hands before it was decided. But yes, I had the enviable position of sitting right next to the table, basically in the front row. And it was awesome. There's no doubt about it. We were there to begin with. We honored two new inductees into the Hall of Fame that we've talked about before, with Eric Seidel and Dan Harrington, two very, very worthwhile people there. I am so glad that they got into it. They deserved it so much. Got through all of that and got to sit down there and actually watch the hands go and the tension and the rest of it. And it was just awesome.
Now,
doubt about it.
By the time they got the heads up, Duhamel had a huge lead over Raisner, one that everybody thought Raisner couldn't possibly overcome, and of course in the long run he couldn't. But when they got there, it was something like 189 million to 30 million,
6-1
6-1 favorite. Before we bring in one of the members of the November 9 who you've lined up, I'm not even sure who it is, but we'll get to him in just a minute. Talk for a moment, if you would, about the heads-up battle and whether you were surprised that it took 43 hands for Duhamel to get rid of Raisner.
Well, actually, Duhamel had a good, solid strategy there. He played small ball, but the problem was small ball for him was not small ball for Raisner. He's making just small bets, and we'll get into the stats in a minute, but you're going to be amazed at the way the two people did played, and because of their stack. I mean, I'm not saying that either one of them played it wrong. That was the way they were kind of forced to do. But he raised on the button virtually every hand that was dealt to him, whereas Raisner virtually limped in every hand that he could. Totally different styles on it. He put pressure constantly on Raisner. It didn't make any difference because you got to realize, especially when he bled down just a few chips, for him to do a 3X bet was going to take a major chunk of his stack.
Yeah, when they started out, the blinds were $600,000 and $1.2 million, and after about 13 minutes, they went up to 800,000 and 1.6 million, which means that, you know, Racer still had a little bit of room to play there, still had, at one point, I guess, about 15 or 18 big blinds, but not much when you're up against the guy who's got 6 to 7 times what you've got in your stack.
And just do the math. If he's continually raising it, he doesn't have to raise it big. It's 2.6 out there before the flop. And he's raising it to 2.6, 2.5, 2.7, somewhere in that range, continually.
Yep.
For you to 3X him, you got to come back with at least a $5 or a $6 million bet. And if you're only sitting on 30, you know, you lose one of those hands and you're crippled.
Yep.
And what he did is he ground him down to about 18 million. They got it all in. Racer won, doubled back up to about 37. Actually got, I think, the peak he was at was about 43 million. And then just ground him back down again.
Yep.
Very, very smartly played. Very, very much the small ball type of a play. But definitely worked.
Now, we've got a lot to talk about here, a lot of hands. When you watch this thing on ESPN tonight, you will see some unbelievable hands. And just a little warning for those of you who are going to record the show on ESPN tonight. It starts at 9 o'clock, 9 o'clock Central Time, and then it goes a little bit past 11. ESPN sent me a note earlier today. Please tell your listeners that the show will not end at 11 o'clock. If they don't record the first 10 minutes of SportsCenter, they're going to miss the end of the heads-up battle. So it'll probably go from 9 o'clock to about 11:05 or 11:10 tonight. Make sure you add a little bit of extra time to your DVR for this evening. And before we go into analysis of other plays and some of the other players, let me just run down the finishing order of the November 9, and then you can introduce us to which one of them you brought with you here today, Dennis. First place, $8.9 million. Goes to Jonathan Duhamel, the first Canadian to ever win this. Second place, John Racner, the Floridian, gets $5.5 million. Joseph Chong, $4.1 million for third place. Filippo Candio, the first Italian to make it to the final table of the main event, gets a little over $3 million. Michael Mizrachi, the first guy nicknamed Grinder to get to the final table, did it with a payday of $2.3 million in fifth place. And then John Dolan was sixth. Jason Sentai, who had gone in as short stack, survived to get a couple of pay bumps and end up in seventh place. Matthew Jarvis, who took a horrible beat, was knocked out in eighth place. And Soy Nguyen, the only one who said he was a complete amateur at the table, who we thought probably would be the first one out, was in fact the one who went out first and landed in ninth and didn't add anything to the $811,000 minimum that they all got for being in the November 9. So which of those guys do you have lined up for us on the show today?
Well, I was able last night to talk while we're up on the stage with the Grinder. And he was willing to come on here and talk for a few minutes about an analysis of the hands and what he saw there and his experience in that. Michael is now, if he wasn't before, and he should have been before, but now is definitely one of the top pros in the country. There's no doubt about it. And he was the guy, and I wanted to ask him about this, where all of the other pros wanted to see win because they think he would be good for the game and wanted to get his kind of foot into that. But I was rooting for him myself. I played against him. He's one of the best players to play. And it should be just a great discussion with him because I really want to hear his take on a few of these hands.
All right, Mike, congratulations, and welcome back to our final table.
Thank you, guys. How you guys doing?
Doing well. Did you get any sleep?
I haven't slept much. I went out. I've been out all night. I was at Tris Nightclub, and tonight I have my victory party at Pure Nightclub, my Players Championship victory party, and my WSOP Final 9 too.
You had an amazing run here, Mike. I mean, not to leave out the stuff in between, but starting it off with the Players Championship 50K bracelet and finishing it up with a fifth place in the main event, you've set a new standard for success at the World Series of Poker. Congratulations on that. I'm curious about, since you were the best-known pro at the table and most of these other guys were young internet hotshots, you have a terrific ability, we know, to read other players. And I was watching some of the feed on ESPN3 on Saturday, and just as a, not even a semi-pro cash game player, I was able to pick up some big-time tells on these guys. How was it for you to sit there and play with these guys, and what did you see?
Well, to tell you the truth, you know, a lot of people probably studied the ESPN prior to the final table. I decided not to really study their tells on the prior because I thought they would study their own tells and use it against everybody, so I didn't want that to affect my game. So I just came there, you know, just pretty much watch hands on TV. I didn't really see anything. And I mean, the hands, a lot of hands I four bet or three or four bet. I had hands where, like, I had two jacks where I four bet where I can make that raise where I can get it off, where I can get off the hand. Like, I re-raised to $10 million when I four bet them with two jacks. If they re-raise, I fold. But I, you know, I had a few hands. I know if I played solid, I was kind of playing, you know, decent cards. I wasn't getting like crazy. Then I can, because I know that these guys will like, they always, you know, I'm known to bluff a lot. And I know if I minimize the bluffs, I can get deep, I'll get deep in the tournament and then I'll just cruise through it. But then I had a chance to take out Dual Mal he called me with, I think it was a pretty bad call with ace nine when I had two threes. And then, you know, I could have took Racer out. The one Racer could have went out with ace queen versus ace king. And I had a shot to go against me. But, you know, at certain points, you got to get lucky. And everybody, I thought everybody played, pretty well. Then Joseph Chung, when he finished in third, I think he didn't have to make that six bet. But he's a little creative. But I thought he played great at the final table as well.
But I like that, and I'm glad you're talking about that. I was curious what your strategy going in was. I noticed you didn't play for a while. I think it was like the 16th, 17th. You went almost twice around the table before you played a hand. Was there a conscious effort to do that, or were you just not catching cards to start with?
There's two reasons for it. The first reason was I didn't get many hands, and I just want to see how the table's going to play out. And then I could represent a tight image and get away with a lot of pots later on. And if I could start 3-4 betting and get away with, and they're gonna credit me for a hand, and I can get away with a lot more things. So I just did it for later on if I finish deep into the tournament. You know, I can get away with a lot more things. And it turned out to be, you know, I did some of my four bets and they folded. But then, you know, the hand where I got knocked out with, I got knocked out with the queen eight versus two aces and against Dual Mal. It was like I knew something was wrong when he limped in the small blind because it wouldn't make sense when I have 18 million. He had such a huge, he's got like 70 million in front of him. You know, usually he'd raise that spot, you know, and then I fought the queen, I didn't really have that many blinds left. And I could have laid it down with king, queen, four, five, rainbow, but I thought he had 10 jacks, kings, or aces. So I thought it was 50-50 with being a huge favorite, if I'm right.
Yeah, and when you get into a hand like that, you know, when you get into a hand with queen eight, you're hoping to flop a queen high board or an eight high board. And if you do, your money's going in, right?
Yeah, well, small blind, big blind, and I was a big blind. He just limped in, and I don't have a choice. I can't fold, so you got to take a flop, and I flopped the queen, and I only have like 17 or 18 million, you know, and the blind's already 601.2, so when he check-raised me, one option, two options, either fold or call, you know, fold or re-raise. And I decided to re-raise and hoping at tens or jacks, and that wasn't the case, and that was it. That was it for me. But I thought I played well. You know, maybe not my best, but I thought I played well. And I thought it was a tough final table. I mean, everyone had a different game. Racer was, Racer probably was the tightest on the table, which I didn't think he'd be the tightest, but he played solid, and they let him cruise to second place. And so he did a great job. I was proud of him, and I was hoping he'd win it yesterday, but, you know, he went to roof room, but, you know, Dumont took it down, and, you know, I'm happy for him. And, you know, he's got a great style, too. He likes to gamble, and he picks his spots.
Well, I got a few interesting facts here, and you're absolutely right for being the tightest favorite. Racer's first three bet wasn't until the 90th hand into this. But I had some other. The first walk given was not until the 58th hand, but this one was good. The first limp didn't happen until a 72nd hand. 72 yeah. hands in it before it was limped around. So there was definitely a lot of aggressive play there for a final table. Granted, it was small play, but there was somebody always taking a stab at the pot, it seemed like, except for Sintai. What was he? In all four times in the first round and a half, something like that, he shoved all in.
Yeah, as the short stack, he kind of had to.
Well, yeah, not that he had too much choice, but four times out of 14 hands, I think it was. He either caught some hands or something, but
We're talking with the grinder, Michael Mizrachi, here at the final table with Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas and Paul Harris here in St. Louis. The grinder came in fifth place in this year's World Series of Poker main event. His buddy, John Reisner, came in second. I'm sure you're happy that John was able to hold on for second place there. I do want to go back to the hand that you mentioned that you played against him where he had shoved all in, and I don't know if he was three betting or four betting at that point, and you tanked for a while, and then you made the call with ace-eight. And the part of it, you know, anybody could debate the strategy of making that call, but I'm curious about making that call when that's your buddy who's doing that. Did that enter into it? Do you think to yourself, well, Reisner wouldn't do this with me unless he had certain things? I mean, did that enter into your strategic decision at that point?
Well, you know, I felt like, you know, it was $9.5 million, almost $10 million, and you know, it's the first time he pretty much three bet me, and I knew he had a hand, but I thought he only had 12 big blinds left, so my thought process was at $65 million in the back of me, and it only cost me about $9 million more, $9-10 million, and it would be down to four players, and you know, you want to take, you know, pretty much the second best player out of the tournament too, and even though he's a friend of mine, I knocked out my own brother too. So you know, I really have no feelings when it comes to the poker table, and I was just pretty much gambling at that point. And at some points, I like to gamble and take a shot when I have enough chips behind me to take that risk.
And the ace king, Reisner's ace king held up, and so he doubled up, and that's what enabled him to stick around for a while longer. I'm sorry, Dennis, I didn't mean to interrupt. I just wanted to finish the hand.
No, and that's fine. Yeah. Actually, on that hand, John Reisner, I mean, ace-queen, he was really, really effectively working his short stack, but he was the short stack on it. He could have had a wide variety of hands there. So, you know, we'll see what happens, but it worked out fairly well, I think, for John Reisner.
Yep. Grinder, tell us what you thought of the three-way battle there when Reisner was such a severe short stack. He had about 10% of the chips, and Chung and Duhamel had 45% of the chips each, and yet the two big stacks went after each other, and Chung had, I don't think you can call it anything less than a blow-up there. What's your take on that?
Well, first off, I didn't even see the hand. I went to do interviews, and before it's like, right when I left the tournament, it seemed like no one wanted to be there anymore, and they just wanted to throw the party and get it over with. So, I mean, it must have lasted, like, I would say not more than 20 hands, maybe less. And the two people got knocked out, I was in shock. I mean, I never thought that would happen. And, you know, I really didn't see the hand. I'm going to see it tonight with the November Niners. We're going to go together and grab a bite, I think, with the WSOP crew and watch a few of the hands and laugh at each other, who bluff too, whatever. But that's never affects me. I mean, I laugh about it, so it's not a big deal to me. I think it's part of the game. It was probably a major mistake for Joseph Chung. I don't think you have to. At that point, you don't have to. You could just cruise to hedge a match, and your plan of attack was supposed to attack John Reisner and knock him out and play heads up because he was a short stack and pick up another $1.5 million and play for the ultimate prize.
So do you think in the way he played, Chung essentially handed your buddy Reisner $2.5 million?
Pretty much, yeah. So I'm sure Reisner appreciates it.
The reaction from Duhamel when he turned over that A7 was unbelievable, though. I mean, he just about did a backflip off of his chair and then turned over the queens. There's no way in the world he put him on an ace-seven there after a six bet.
Yeah, for our audience, let me just explain the hand, which, again, you'll see tonight on ESPN. But Chung raises it to $2.9 million from the small blind after Reisner had folded his button. And remember, we're three-handed here, and Reisner's a severe short stack. But he folds his button, which he did, by the way, seven times in a row. After Chung makes it $2.9 million, Duhamel in the big blind makes it $6.75 million. Chung then four bets to $14 million and change. Duhamel comes back with a five bet to 22.75, which is effectively at that point a min raise. Then Chung checks his hand, thinks about his decision. Everybody's quiet, quiet, quiet. And then finally Chung announces he's all in. He six bet shoves there. Duhamel insta calls. Chung turns over ace of spades, seven of hearts, and Duhamel calls with queens. I'm curious, both Michael Mizrachi and Dennis Phillips for your thoughts on six bet shoving with ace seven and calling a six bet shove with queens. Grinder, we'll start with you.
Well, I mean, that hand is it's crazy. I mean, that's a crazy hand. I mean, six bet, and I don't know what went through Joseph Chung's head. I mean, he obviously maybe thought he had a read, or maybe he didn't care, or maybe just, you know, thought like he knew like the situation that maybe he didn't want to play such a big pot. Maybe he could fold, maybe try to let him get in the fold tens or jacks, and knew that they're both big stack, and maybe a fold just to at least of, you know, get his heads up and know it's worth $1.5 million more, and it's a lot more money, and it's a big difference, you know, when you're heads up and three handed, just the fact that the money jump and then you come back Monday night and play for it all, and you get your head clear and everything, and maybe he thought he had a read, or maybe he just wanted to gamble. I don't know what went through Joseph Chung's head, and the best person to ask is probably Joseph Chung.
And what about you, Dennis?
Well, I pretty much agree. I try and give him the benefit of a doubt that he had some sort of a read or something on that, or maybe he just honestly didn't think, being three-handed and being a short stack, that there's no way in the world Duhamel would call an all-in there unless he had, you know, a premium hand. Well, I'm sorry, but three-handed, queens is a premium hand. So he's just not laying it down. There's no way in the world I would lay down queens. Well, I can't say that, but I'm saying it would be very rare that I would lay down pocket queens pre-flop on a three-handed table. Very, very rare.
Do you think
the insta-call was there.
Do you think that Duhamel's min-raise 5-bet was essentially an invitation to Chung, and he was saying, look, if you want to shove it all in, I'm going to call you. Go ahead.
Well, he had a little over $90 million there. He was only putting in the $22 million. He still had a substantial stack behind him. He had fold equity. There's no doubt that he could have folded with another hand, and had he had those pocket nines or pocket tens or something, he could have considered folding there for sure, because he could have been looking at a race. But with queens, you're not going to fold it. And if Chung thought he had some sort of read, he was evidently wrong, because he had the hand.
Yeah, it was a $177 million pot, by far the largest pot in World Series of Poker history, and it knocked Joseph Chung, who was the chip leader, knocked him down to about $10 million in chips and essentially sealed his fate, because at that point, John Reisner, with about $30 million, could literally fold his way into second place, because those $10 million in chips were eventually going to go in. Grinder, tell us about the experience of playing under the lights. You, of course, had done it in the 50K Players Championship that opened up the World Series of Poker, but at that final table, you were the only one who had had that intense spotlight on them. Tell us about the experience and how your experience in that situation played into it, and whether you think exhaustion might have come into play towards the end of that nearly 14-hour first day on Saturday.
Well, first off, I've been in the spotlight for years already, and you know, it started with the World Poker Tour, and I think it was 2005 when they had one versus Dan Negreanu. That was pretty much my first spotlight tournament with all the cameras, lights. You know, the first time I was a little nervous, but I didn't think it would affect me because I'm a poker player, and some people don't like the spotlight, but I don't mind it. You know, it doesn't affect me. But the World Series of Poker main event spotlight and compared to any other ones, it's a big difference. And there's, you know, enormous crowd. You're in the Penn and Teller Theater. Thousands of people watch you, millions and millions of people watching around the world. And so it's a different feeling, and nerves come into play sometimes. But those guys didn't seem nervous, you know, at first. And once you sit down for the first half hour, you know, that's when your nerves comes off and you get comfortable and you're just ready to play poker. So pretty much, you know, and I thought it's going to help. I thought I'd finish well just because of that, and I thought that was in my favor because of the spotlight. But I don't really think it affected anybody. I thought everybody played fairly well, I thought everybody just played fairly well. But unfortunately, I finished in fifth, and I wish I got it. I was a chip lead with, like, I think it was six to go, 6-7. I put myself in a good spot. I had 67 million or 65 to 67 million. Next guy had 37. So I thought it was it from there. But, you know, sometimes you got to win those flips. And if it doesn't go your way, what can you do? That's the luck part of the game.
Well, obviously you played well. There's no doubt about that. And again, for the listeners here, you went from a starting stack of about $14 million up to just under 70. I don't think you ever quite broke the 70 million mark, but you were in the high 60s there. So you definitely dominated the table during that middle area there and did a tremendous job of it. You were pretty much the favorite, the one that all of the pros were wanting to do because we thought you would be good for the game. And I still think that, and I think you will be good for the game. Where do you go from here? What's your next goal or your next achievement, or what are you going to try and do for and with poker?
Well, my goal now is just keep playing, do my thing. I always prefer cash games, and I was always a cash game player, by the way, guys. That's how I got the name Grinder. So I had the name for such a long time. But, my next step is probably maybe go to L.A. for a little bit for a few days, play some cash games. And I know they have one of the tournaments out there. I think it's an NAPT. I'm not sure at the bike. So I'm going to go play that tournament. And from there on, I don't know my schedule. I'm probably going to head back to South Florida and hang out, play some cash games there. And I'll check the schedule out. And but I live by minutes and minutes, day by day. You know, I never know where I'm going. I never know what I'm going to do next. So that's a life, of a poker player, and exciting. I like to live a spontaneous life.
Well, Mike, congratulations again on all the success. A huge start and a pretty darn good finish to the 2010 World Series of Poker, and of course the success in the middle of it as well. We think that this is just the next step up a great career ladder for you. I think this puts you in the top 10 all-time money list. You may even be in the top 5. I don't know what the exact numbers are, but you really have established yourself as an even bigger name in the world of poker, and we're really, really happy you could spend a little time with us here this afternoon talking about the big event before it even plays out on TV.
No
one
problem.
One quick question.
I think I'm in the seventh, by the way.
I'm sorry, Dennis. What, you had one last question for Mike?
Oh, yeah, just a real simple one. Just how sweet are those cash games in Florida now with the changing of the laws?
A lot of the pros came to South Florida, but, like, the better games are, like, the 5-10 no limit. You got to be disciplined to play, for a player like me. So, but I'll play it. But I'm more going to play more on Full Tilt Poker and just play like 5 games and just play a lot of, 10-20 no limit or PLO. And, when I'm in Florida, I like to play, sometimes in private games and big PLO games. But, I think I'm going to do a lot of my playing online when I get back and play a lot of tournaments on Full Tilt. And I also have my $2,000 buy-in on Full Tilt. I'll be hosting that November 20th.
Great. Sweet.
Oh, and don't forget about the Deep Stack, too. Anybody that wants to learn how to play high-quality poker needs to check out the Deep Stack and some of the games you've got going on down there in Florida, some of the lessons you're giving, correct?
Yeah, deepstacklive.com or deepstack360 with Mike, Mattisau, myself, and Tristan Wade, and we have a lot of other pros, and it's a great learning experience. I just did a camp last week with Mike, Mattisau, and Tristan, and it was unbelievable, and it was a great turnout, and it was our first 360 camp, and had a great time, and I think that's my next step, is to teach in poker.
Cool.
Terrific. Terrific. All right, Mike, we're going to let you go. Get some sleep, for goodness sake, and thanks again, and congratulations again.
Thanks a lot, guys. Take care.
All right. Take care.
That is Michael Mizrachi, the Grinder, fifth-place finisher at this year's World Series of Poker main event, which, as we told you, is going to air tonight on ESPN, but we are talking about it in this hour. He was involved in an unbelievable hand that eliminated Matt Jarvis. We're going to talk about that and analyze some of the other stuff and get into some of the other stories from this weekend in the next segment of The Final Table. Dennis Phillips is in Las Vegas, having been there watching the heads-up battle last night. I'm Paul Harris here at the Poker Room at Harrah's St. Louis, where, by the way, next Tuesday, as soon as we get off the air at 4 o'clock, Harrah's has asked me to help them get together a new 2-5 game. There hasn't been a midweek 2-5 game in St. Louis for a while, and so we're going to try to start one up here on Tuesday afternoons. A lot of 2-5 players who used to play on a regular basis have been asking, where can I go and play in a game like this in the middle of the week? Well, this will be the place. It'll start at 4 o'clock, and if you want to play, you can start calling into the Harrah's Poker Room at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and reserve your spot. I'm going to be playing in the game, and I'm going to buy pizza for everybody for dinner. You know, probably around 6 o'clock, whoever's been in the game for a couple of hours, the pizza will be on me. So I hope you'll come down and join us in the poker room at Harrah's St. Louis for the new Tuesday 2-5 game starting next week, November 16th. Also, when you come down here, you'll see that the area outside of the poker room is now smoke-free, as well as the area inside the poker room, which has been smoke-free for years. So it's an even better environment to come to on this side of the casino. Of course, if you're a smoker, there's still plenty of places to go in Harrah's. In fact, I would say the vast majority of the casino outside of the poker room, you can still smoke in and play your favorite table games and slot machines and all the rest. And of course, they got great restaurants here, from Charlie Gito's to the Eat Up Buffet to Grill 21 and so much more. So this is the place to come. Harrah's St. Louis, the home of the World Series of Poker Poker Room, where, by the way, you can start qualifying for next year's main event in January. Details on that coming up on future episodes of The Final Table here on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com, and our podcasts through iTunes and on thechipleader.com. Welcome back to the poker room at Harrah's St. Louis, the home of the Final Table Poker Radio Show. I am Paul Harrah's here in St. Louis with my partner Dennis Phillips, who is out in Las Vegas on the morning after the big finale of the World Series of Poker main event. The Canadian Jonathan Duhamel taking it down and winning almost $9 million after a 43-hand heads-up battle with the Floridian John Raisner. Joseph Chong in third place with an incredible blow-up that I thought was completely unnecessary, which is what makes it a blow-up, of course. And we're going to get into more of that in just a second. First, this portion of the show is brought to you by PokerStars.net, the online poker site where you can play with and against pros like Dennis Phillips.
Absolutely, and I'm telling you, if you want to learn the game and want to learn how to play it right, go to PokerStars.net. It makes no difference what level you come in at. They have a game there and the strategy to teach you and improve your game. Because remember, this is a no-limit game. These games, you can always be improving. Guarantee the Grinder that was on here earlier is still trying to improve his game. So go to PokerStars.net, download the software, and start learning. I don't care whether it's Omaha, PLO, Deuce to Seven, Triple Draw, or, of course, one of my favorites, the No-Limit Hold'em. They'll have a game there 24/7. It's the best software in the business. It's the best game in the business. Go there and play. And tell you what, some of the prizes they have are just phenomenal. Next week, we're going to be going out to L.A. to play in the NAPT there. You can qualify for free, go to a game like that, or you can go to Australia, or you can go to Argentina, or you can go to London, or you can go to Monte Carlo. Name a place in the world, practically, and there's probably a tournament going on somewhere near there. And PokerStars is probably involved in it. So anytime you want to have some fun, go there, download the software, learn how to play, and start having it. Because I tell you, you can have a tremendous amount of fun, and it can be quite profitable.
Yeah, very profitable. Six of the last main event champions, including Jonathan Duhamel, wearing the Poker Stars patch.
Yes.
Pretty
good.
Cool
lineup of people.
Pretty amazing. By the way, we talked about patches last week and who would be wearing what on TV. Duhamel and Jason Sentai were wearing the Poker Stars gear. Joseph Chong, John Dolan, Michael Mizrachi were in the full Tilt gear. They were only allowed to have three, even though seven guys were sponsored by Tilt. Only three of them were allowed to actually wear it. But some of them had other things on. The ones who couldn't wear a patch from Stars or Tilt were wearing things from Card Runners, and there was a clothing line there, and the Flip Your House guy had bought some sleeve patches. Matt Jarvis was wearing a Canadian casino patch on his chest. I was glad to see a couple of Bad Beat on Cancer 1% green patches on them. And I was also glad to see some PPA patches for the Poker Players Alliance.
Yeah, definitely. We're slowly breaking into the corporate world, and they're slowly getting the acceptance of poker as a sport and as an entertainment value. And that's just going to continue to grow. More and more people are playing poker. More and more people are enjoying it. Eventually, it will be accepted into mainstream America in full, wide-blown whatever.
Yep.
It may not be yet, but it's getting there more and more every day.
Speaking of sponsorships, the WSOP announced this week that they have signed a multi-year renewal with Jack Link's Beef Jerky, which means Norman Chad is going to have to do the Jack Link's wild card hand for at least three more years.
Okay, cool.
Now, let's talk about, I didn't get into this with Grindr, but we have to talk about when people watch the coverage tonight on ESPN, there is going to be one hand that is going to make them go, oh, my God. And it was the hand that knocked out Matthew Jarvis in eighth place. After Soy Wynn had gone out with an ace-king against Queens, you and I have talked so many times about guys who get knocked out of tournaments with ace-king. It's a death hand. But on hand number 43, Duhamel had raised it up to $1.4 million, and Grindr just flat called. And when it got around to Matthew Jarvis, he only had $14 million left, and so he shoved it all in. The Grindr took a few minutes to consider, and I think in his mind it might have even been close to 50-50. But Grindr made the call. Duhamel, who was the original raiser, was gone at this point, and so they went heads up with Mizrachi's ace-queen of diamonds against Jarvis's pair of nines, the classic race, which looked like it was over on the flop when it came two queens and an eight, giving Grindr trip queens, and people went nuts until the turn card was a nine, giving Jarvis nines full of queens, which would seem to be good enough to win this hand. Until what Norman Chad calls the most beautiful card in the deck, the ace of spades comes off on the river and gives Grindr queens full of aces and eliminates Matthew Jarvis. Dennis, I don't know if you know this, but it was a near replay of a hand from 7 years ago in the main event. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I absolutely do. That's the one that Phil Ivey got eliminated on. Not exactly his favorite replay hand.
This was Ivey versus Moneymaker at the 03 event, which, of course, Chris went on to win. But in that case, it was ace-queen versus a pair of nines. The flop came queen-queen-six. This was queen-queen-eight this year. It was queen-queen-six. They did not get the money in pre-flop. They did not get the money in on the flop. They got it in on the turn when the nine came. At that point, Ivy has nines full of queens and is way ahead and gets all the money in. And Moneymaker makes the call and then hits the sick suck-out ace on the river. That, to me, that was even sicker than what happened this year. But I was also reminded of, what was the hand 2 years ago when you were at the final table? You were not involved in the hand, but somebody hit a one-outer six. What was that hand? Who was involved in that?
Yeah, that was Peter Eastgate that ended up winning the hand and catching it. And it was actually against Scotty Montgomery, I believe. And it came down to the river. There was only two sixes left. That hadn't been shown. I threw a six away.
Yeah.
So I knew that the six of diamonds was the only card that could do it because I threw the six of clubs away.
Yep.
A preflop. And when that six of diamonds came out there, I will have to admit, and I got to give credit to him, Scott Montgomery had gotten several miracle cards to make it as far as he did. And when that six hit, he said, well, if it's going to happen to somebody, it's appropriate that it happened to me.
Yep.
So I'll give him credit for that. But, yeah, that was a basically a two-percenter. Have you actually – now, I'm doing these in my head, so I'm probably off a little bit. Pre-flop, and I think you're exactly right. In fact, it might have been so close on the call here that the Grindr, if it had not been the suited ace-queen, both being diamonds, he might have laid it down. I think that's how close the call was, that extra 3% might have made the difference.
Because at that point, Grindr was still in seventh place. He had not amassed a huge amount of chips. We're only 43 hands into this.
Yeah, I think it was a little better than seventh place, but he was definitely, he'd gone from 14 to maybe, oh, I'm guessing 25, somewhere around that range. And I think Jarvis had about 18. I'm kind of guessing at that. But 14.3, so the Grindr had maybe 27 then. So it was going to cost him over half his chips to make this call.
Yep.
This was a serious call. There's no doubt about it. And I'm telling you, that extra 3% doesn't sound like much, but at that level, you consider it. And I think because it was suited, that may have made the difference on the call there, just that little bit of bitty bit.
Yep.
So anyhow, the percentages here, pre-flop, you know, you're not looking that much different. It is close to classic race. The nines are ahead. I'm guessing 54, 46, somewhere in that range, maybe 55, 45, but definitely the nines are ahead. Now, the two queens and the eight comes out. Do a total flip around, and it goes up to 91% probably that the Grinders favored?
Yep. I think Jarvis is about 8% there.
92 then. Okay, somewhere in that range. Now the 9 comes out. And all of a sudden, he's looking, and if my math is right, you've got 3 aces, 3 eights, and a queen left for 7 outs. So you're looking at now it does a total flip around the other way, and all of a sudden, Jarvis is favored by about 85% of the time. Talk about unbelievable.
Yeah.
So you catch a 2-outer on the turn and a 7-outer on the river.
Yep.
That's just unbelievable.
That's what we call suck, resuck poker. Big time. Now, we briefly touched on this when Grinder was on here, but I didn't want to pressure him because I don't want to say that Michael blew up, because I don't really think he did. I think he's a great pro and a great player, and you two are friends, and I didn't want to put him on the spot while he was on here. But I do want to ask you about the hand in which he shoves with threes. Duhamel had raised a 2.5 from the small blind. Mizrachi makes a re-raise for all of his chips, and Duhamel makes the call for his last 27.25. Duhamel at that point was the short stack. So Grinder's trying to put pressure on him, but he's only got a pair of threes. And Duhamel's got ace nine. With a pair of threes and a guy who's fairly short stacked, you know that the best you're going to do if he does call is race. Is that a mistake by Grinder to shove at that point? And is it, on the other hand, for Duhamel, I mean, we know it worked out for him because a 9 came on the flop and on the turn, so he locked up the hand. But ace 9 offsuit for your stack there, Dennis, was that a mistake?
If I had to, criticize either one of the plays, and now remember to qualify this, I'm not sitting at the table. I don't have the kind of reads. The Grinder's got great reads against people. There's no doubt about that.
Yep.
So there may have been something in here that I'm unaware of, not privy to. So I'm going to qualify it that way. It was small blind versus big blind. Duhamel made his standard bet in the small blind, raising it to $2.5 million. I'm telling you right there, majority of people, myself included probably, when he shoved, and we're talking about a tournament life, and I'm sitting with an ace-nine offsuit, I would probably not have made that call. I flat out would have laid it down, and his shove would have taken it, and at that time, he had the chips to be able to be the bully, and I think that's what he was trying to do. And he's very good at it.
Yep.
But, that was such a huge, huge pile when he called it. He had put in $2.5 million into the pot in small blind. I think he started out the hand with a little over $20 million, correct?
27 or, yeah.
So he had 25 million.
I think close to $30 million when he started the hand.
You're shoving in there with an ace nine. Your only hope for a race here is that he has a pocket eights or less.
Yep.
And I'm telling you, that is not a good call. It worked, obviously, and he went on to win it. So I hate to second guess him, but I honestly think if there was one hand in here that Duhamel made at the very least a questionable call, it was with that ace nine offsuit.
Well,
I would have laid it down.
Well, you've said it many times, and anybody who's had any success in tournament poker knows you don't win it unless you get lucky along the way. Remember, Duhamel got incredibly lucky against Matt Affleck in that jacks against aces hand where Duhamel sucked out a straight on the river to knock Matt Affleck out, and Duhamel didn't have a huge stack of chips himself if he loses that hand, and he was willing to put it all in there with jacks at a very risky point there. So, so many things can go either way at any point in a tournament. One moment you're the hero, the next you're gone. So I agree with you. That call with ace nine, I'm not sure about the shove with threes, to be honest with you. If I'm in that situation, I probably am going to raise and see what the guy does. And if he shoves, then have to make a new decision. But I think the call with ace nine off suit seemed awfully, awfully risky.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way in the... I just don't agree with it. Like I said, it worked out. I wasn't at the table. There could have been so many other things going on, so who knows. But if I have to pick between the two, I think the Grinder's move is a better move than calling with the ace-nine.
We're going to have Jonathan Duhamel either on next week's show or the show on the 23rd. Before we get him in here, I don't know him at all. I don't know if you do. I know he's aligned with PokerStars, so you're certainly going to get to know him. Is this 23-year-old Canadian going to be good for poker?
Actually, I think he is. He is an extremely intelligent guy, very articulate, seems to have his head on straight. I think he will be. We'll see what the next year brings. But definitely my vote is that, yes, he's going to be, and I'm glad PokerStars signed him.
This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show every Tuesday at 3 on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com, and our podcast available through thechipleader.com. I do want to get a plug in for a charity poker tournament here in St. Louis on Friday, November 26th. That would be on Thanksgiving weekend. It is a fundraiser for the Bobby Orff 17 Scholarship. This is a group that helps out hockey players in the area, named after Bobby Orff, a kid who got hurt playing hockey. It is going to be a buffet dinner and charity poker tournament going on at the Holiday Inn at Six Flags. And if you're interested in information, we will put a link up on Dennis's website, thechipleader.com, for Thanksgiving weekend. We'll have a lot of people who will be in town and want to get away from the family for a little while on that weekend. That might be a very nice thing to do. Also, I mentioned that a couple of the players were wearing the PPA patch. Talk a little bit about the importance of the PPA now that we're a week past the election.
Well, people need to remember that the emphasis is still going on. We are still fighting to get the changes that we want made over there in Washington and even at a state level. So it's even more important now than before. We've made major progress. Senator Bennett, the co-sponsor of the bill from Colorado, was reelected by a slim, slim margin. And I guarantee that if the PPA and the people, the poker players out there, had not backed him, the 17,000 strong that they are in Colorado, he may not have won that election. In fact, there's a good chance he probably wouldn't have. Harry Reid here in Nevada won his election again by a very small margin, and he was backed by the PPA, and he had the fundraisers, and he had the people going out and telling everybody that, you know, you should vote for Harry Reid because he does believe in this freedom, and he does believe that we should have the right to be able to play these games in our house. So there's a ton of other things going on. Hopefully something will come during this lame duck session and they'll be able to move it forward. But if it does or doesn't, don't forget the PPA is out there fighting for you, fighting to make sure that we can play poker at any time in our own home without the restrictions that the government's trying to pose on us. So get out there. If you haven't joined the PPA, you need to join the PPA. There is absolutely no question about that. If you enjoy playing poker and you support the freedoms that are associated with it, join the PPA. It's very simple. Go to thePPA.org. Put your $20 down and join me.
All right, and join us because we're both members, and so are so many pros and amateurs as well. We'd love to have you as a member of the organization. All right, a few other random things about the World Series of Poker main event finale, which again will air tonight on ESPN. It starts at 9 o'clock Central Time. Scheduled to go to a little bit after 11. If you have your DVR set, though, it might cut off at 11 o'clock. Make sure you add some extra time so it goes about maybe 5 or maybe 10 minutes into SportsCenter so you don't miss the end of the main event. I don't think we're going to see a lot of hands from the 43 hands they played heads up because there wasn't all that much. You know, ESPN got some criticism 2 years ago when you were part of the initial November 9, that they only showed two hands between Eastgate and Demidoff over a remarkably long stretch. This was even more anticlimactic. I can't imagine we're going to see more than two hands from that tonight. Do you?
Well, no, and I actually got some of the figures here because I knew it was happening. I just wasn't for sure how extensive it was, but this is going to shock you. Now, granted, Duhamel, major stack. He's the guy that should be putting the pressure. He's the guy that should be doing the bully and everything. That's fine. John Reisner, short stacks, got to be very careful. Can run into a major problem if any kind of a three-betting goes on. Now, to explain that a little bit, if you're starting out with 25 million, your opponent raises it from the 1.6 at the big blind up to 2.7, 2.8, somewhere around that. For you to come back and do a raise over that, you're going to have to make it 5.5, 6 million, something in that range, which is probably going to be maybe 20 to a quarter of your chips. So it's going to be very, very difficult. And Duhamel continually, hand after hand after hand, put the pressure on. It is the way he should do it. But he just, he had Reisner all the way down to 18 million. He doubled up when he caught the pocket queens back up to about 37, got up, I think, a little over 40, and then he just started grinding him back down. Now, listen to this. In the 43 hands, Jonathan Duhamel never gave a walk, never once let him have a walk and folded his small blind.
Of course, when you're playing heads up, when you're playing heads up, Dennis, in that situation, would you ever give a walk?
Absolutely. I guarantee when I played at the NBC, everyone there from Annie Duke down, from the first place down to it, at some time looks down at a deuce seven and says, it's not worth throwing in even the rest of it. I give the guy a walk.
Okay.
Duhamel, never. 43 hands, never gave a walk. All right, 43 hands, so you are on the button 21 times, say. Jonathan Duhamel raises 16 of those times. John Reisner raised 2. It's unbelievable.
Yep.
Reisner limped 15 times, was re-raised a number of times from the big blind, but 15 out of those 21 or 22 times he limped, trying to see a flop, trying to do something. And in the entire 43 hands, John Reisner only twice did a 3-bet.
Now, I got an email from one of our listeners named Mark, who said that if he were in either of these guys' positions, he would have just shoved in every hand. Because Duhamel, with that more than 6-1 lead, and maybe you double them up once if he gets lucky. And if you're Reisner, look, you're guaranteed second place money. You're such a huge dog. With any two cards, you shove and take your chances, and maybe you get lucky and you double up, and now you can play some poker. What's your response to that?
I totally disagree with that on both sides.
Do you like the way the guys played it?
Duhamel played it. He played small ball till it was so boring. But I'm telling you, his small ball with the continual small raises did nothing but put pressure on Reisner.
Yep.
Pressure, 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 and ground him down so that he was continually short stacked, and it just kept getting worse. I don't know the percentage of the 43 hands, how many of them that Duhamel won. He probably won 2 out of every 3 hands.
Yeah.
And it just did it. Reisner was sitting back there now then. Yeah, sure, you can just take it and shove with any 2 cards and cross your fingers or whatever. There's a reason why he made it to the final 2 out of 7,300 people. Probably because he didn't just shove it with any 2 cards.
Yep, he was the most patient player of the final 9. He was either extremely
Absolutely.
Card dead or extremely patient for most of this. And, to work his way up from nearly being out of it to ending up with a $5.5 million payday, nothing wrong there. We will either have Reisner or Duhamel on the next 2 shows here of the Final Table. Before we finish up, I want to compliment the people from ESPN3.com who did the live stream both Saturday night for 14 hours and last night for a couple of hours. James Hardigan, the British guy who did the play-by-play, was in the booth the whole time. I thought he was terrific. Adam Schoenfeld was with him, a poker pro who's got a great sense of humor. He was good. Helmuth was in there. Our friend Bernard Lee was in there. John Aguiar was in there. It was terrific to watch. Now, they're only going to have a small audience there because it's going to be poker players who are the only ones who will sit through the pace of live poker without being able to see the whole cards, which is what that live feed was all about. You'll get to see it, what Hardigan calls cards up, tonight on ESPN. But they did a terrific job. I think a lot of people who watched it were surprised to see poker on TV or on their computer screens anyway without seeing the cards and seeing the slow pace of that. But if you're a cash game player or a tournament player, you know what that real pace is. And I think that was fantastic, and I look forward to them doing it every year. We've only got 15 seconds to go, Dennis. Where are you headed to next?
Well, there's a ton of things going on. I did want to put in a little plug for Lawrenceburg, Indiana. They've got a tournament coming up there, year-end finale, on the 20th and 21st. They've invited me over. Chris Moneymaker's going to be over there. Paul, you're going over there, I hope.
Yep.
And it should be some fun over there. TK puts on a heck of a tournament. Great place if you've never been over there, to Hollywood Casino in Lawrenceburg, Indiana.
We'll talk about that next week as the final table returns Tuesdays at 3 on 590 The Fan, KFNS and KFNS.com, and our podcast through iTunes and on the ChipLeader.com.